Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome back to the Beer Ladies podcast. I am Lisa, and I am your host today. Hello. And we are very, very excited because not only do we have some of our regular folks, but we have a special guest today. And this topic is a little bit of a departure for us, but it's one that we've been thinking about for a while. And that, as I'll get into later, I did some important market research on over the past couple of weeks to find out what people know, don't know, want to know about this topic. But before we dive into that and introduce our guest, I'll first say hello to Katie and hello to Christina.
Hi.
And they're waving. And we are really, really excited because our topic is Whiskey 101 for Beer Nerds. So this is really assuming you may know nothing about whiskey. This is just going to give you the basics, but we'll also talk a little bit about just what some of the terminology you come across, what does it all mean, and a little bit about what's special about Irish whiskey. But we can't do that ourselves, and that is why we have brought on world-renowned drinks writer, Mr. Lou Bryson. Lou, say hello.
How are you? Hello. Oh,
we are hey, so Lou. Excited to have you. So excited to have you. So for those who don't know, first of all, you should be following Lou on all the socials. He has some amazing books out. He's got many, many out about beer. I have two of his whiskey books behind me. So I have Whiskey Masterclass and Tasting Whiskey. But Lou and I go way back from the Pennsylvania beer scene. So I'm very, very happy to have him here. But before we dive into all of that, I do want to say our usual spiel, which is we are at Beer Ladies Pod on most of the socials. You can follow us there. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Mastodon. We are on YouTube. You can buy us a pint. All of the things, just look for Beer Ladies Pod. You can go to our link tree for Beer Ladies Podcast. We'll talk about it again at the end. But before we do that, we will get into what we're all drinking, and then we'll find out a little bit more about how Lou kind of got onto this topic and what are the things that we just don't know about it. So I'd like to start with our guest. So Lou, what have you got? And I know we're making you do some day drinking. It's a hard life, but
sorry. It's okay.
What have you got?
Well, whiskey first. We're all doing Irish today. Still getting used to this. Redbreast. I have a Redbreast 12-year-old. The classic, what they call single pot still or mixed mash whiskey, and we'll get into all that. But it was one that was actually introduced to me by Fergus Carey in Philadelphia.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah,
I got my first sip of it from him.
Oh, Fergus is a legend. If you don't know, he's
amazing. He's like the unofficial mayor of Philadelphia.
Yes.
And for beer, I have my local brew pub, Elk Creek Cafe and Ale Works, here in, as I like to say, the smack dab center of Pennsylvania. In Milheim, Pennsylvania, a tiny little town that we just moved to about a year ago. This is their Brookie Brown Ale.
That looks lovely.
And the beautiful thing is I can get a brown ale anytime it's open. They always have the brown ale on, which is rare anymore.
Yeah, we are team brown ale here, as our regular listeners know. So we are always trying to manifest more brown ales into existence. So that is wonderful to hear.
And that's also a great thing.
Yeah, we'll also say, listeners, if you want to hear more about Milheim, listen to Lou's podcast, See Through a Glass. It is, I have to say, even just as if I didn't already know you, I would just find it so soothing to hear, you know, your dulcet tones as you highlight some of the local food, drink producers. It's just really fascinating to hear what's going on in another part of the food and drink world. So
thank you.
So thank you, Lou. Katie, what have you got?
So myself, Lou, and Lisa are all drinking, I believe, the same whiskey. I have mine from Tiny Tipple.
Same.
And I love the cute little bottles that they come in, right?
Oh, aren't they?
They are lovely. I actually got my husband a selection of their gins for Christmas.
Oh, yes.
You know, if you don't want to go out and buy the expensive bottles, you can just buy little sets. I think it's a brilliant idea. And I love the lovely wax seal on it.
Oh, yeah. And we'll say not SpawnCon. We're just fans. We love their business model, what they do. I don't think you could do their business model in the US because there's complicated laws of what you can ship where, yes, to whom. It's all very different. But sorry, go ahead, Katie. What have you got for your
and
beer?
My beer is a Hope Dublin Porter.
Oh, very
which
nice.
Which has appeared on this podcast, I believe it.
It has.
Before. So this is still there from my Christmas collection.
Yep.
And, yeah. Can I have very a look nice at it? It's a very nice porter. There we go.
Yeah.
It is lovely. And Christina, I know you're doing more of a show and tell than a drink tonight, but what have you got?
So I actually was sent this a while ago, a couple years ago, I think. So this is the Tula Mordu triple distilled whiskey, which is kind of famous. Tula Mordu, I think, it's kind of famous here in Ireland. Full disclosure, I'm not the biggest whiskey fan, so I'm really excited to like learn more. Even though I have found myself on many a whiskey tour and many a whiskey tasting. So I have a list of questions, Lou, that I'm prepared to ask you. But it always looks so good. So, you know, maybe I just need some more education.
maybe it's finding the right one. Yeah.
I'm kind of similar there to Christina. It smells nice as well. I like the smell of whiskey. It's just this, it burns a little.
Oh, yeah. It's like backing up to a mule and letting it kick you. Yeah. There's no way around that.
That was an incredibly evocative statement. I love it. Oh, gosh. And I will go to the beer I got, because we already said I've got the Redbreast 12 as well, also from Tiny Tipples. I have the McNutty Macadamia Nut Brown Ale from Lochgill. And this is always good. And it's a lovely sort of deep brown color. Again, we love our brown ales. This is one that tends to be pretty available. Although I say that at the bar we were all at the other night, I could see it on the tap handle and it had kicked, and I felt personally, you know, like they had done it to me. But anyway, that's okay. I've got a can.
So. Yeah. And so, if you sense a lack of enthusiasm today, I think it's because we all did the dog the other night.
Oh, I closed Elk Creek Saturday night. So
Please drink responsibly. I mean, again, we were all very good. Everyone got taxis home. We were all, you know, very
I'm
well
lucky
looked after.
It's a 3-minute walk for me. So
yes, even better. So I think it's a go ahead, Katie.
Yeah. Oh no, I was gonna say I had the joys of the C5, the night bus.
But at least it's there now. At least it's there now. So I think we have a lot of basic questions about whiskey, even though, again, I have these two excellent books behind me, which have been a very good introduction, but there's still a lot of, I would say, terminology and just things that are like, once you nerd out about it, I'm sure you get it. But I did some, I'll say, light market research over the past couple weekends, talking to beer nerds, and almost to a man or woman, but it was mostly to a man just because that's, you know, how it was. They all said, I don't know enough. I'd like to know more. There's a lot of terminology that I find confusing. I don't know what these things mean. I don't want to kind of look stupid, but so a lot of just like, I'd like to know more, but I don't know where to go, or I'd like to go maybe do a tasting, but I don't know what I'll like. And I think a lot of people too have come across, I don't know if it was a mule, but I know for me, I don't tend to like smokier things, but I think a lot of people first come across these very smoky whiskeys, and there's lots of different kinds. So maybe we'll just sort of start with Katie, if you want to read the back of your people's description, I think that gives us a great place to start.
Okay, so there's lots of words in this, and I know what the word means, but when you put them all together, I don't, what exactly does it mean? So it's a 100% heavy pot still whiskey, with the E, of course, whiskey with the E, with a high sherry aging percentage, It is a pure pot still Irish whiskey aged for a minimum of 12 years.
What does it mean?
We can do all that. So let's do the middle first. The pure pot still. The interesting thing there is that's actually older terminology because some people get upset about the whole pure thing because pure is it's kind of like saying old. How pure? How old?
Okay.
So it wouldn't be taken as a quality statement, but rather as a statement of, which it is, a statement of process, how the whiskey is actually made. They took to calling it single pot still, which I don't think is a lot more less confusing, but it's not pure. So what that really means is, now that I've gone through all that blather, it's a mixed mash whiskey. It's more than one grain. And in this case, I mean, this is one of the things that makes some Irish whiskey unique. What they use is a mixture of malt, unmalted barley, and then they may add a third or even a fourth grain. But usually it's just, and when I say usually, I mean, Redbreast is malt and raw barley. And, you know, you were saying about all the stuff that beer people want to know about. And one of the things that and I can't believe I'm saying this because I fought against it for years when I was younger, you really have to go because I read about this and I drank it and all that. And I had people tell me about it, who'd been there. And the instant I walked into the brewery at Middleton, I was like, Oh, because it smelled like nothing else I'd ever smelled. They were cooking this raw barley and malt together. And it just had this, you know, the word that came to mind was green. It was so fresh. It was just an amazing aroma. And all of a sudden, I had like a whole new layer of understanding to Redbreast and single pot still. So that's what the single pot still is. Now, the heavy pot, the thing with whiskey is there's always this point where people are learning about whiskey, and they come to the point where they realize that, oh my God, all the whiskeys this place makes, and they may make, I mean, Middleton, Jameson makes, 10, 12 different kinds of whiskey. They all have the same recipe, and they immediately think they're the same whiskey, but it's not like beer. I mean, and actually beer isn't like beer either. I mean, you can have the same grains going in, do a different fermentation, do different hops, do a different yeast, and it'll change the beer completely. But for some reason, people don't want to get that with whiskey. They're just like, I found out a secret thing. Well, you did, but you didn't. I mean, look at all the different single malt scotches. They all have the same grain bill. It's all 100% malt, bang, done. And yet they're all different. So one of the things they do differently with the heavy pot still, so a pot still, round copper part, stack coming off the top, and then an arm going off to the side. Each one of those things, if you change the shape, the geometry of it, changes the whiskey. If the... And it all comes down to what they call reflux. I'm not going to bother going into how all those things change, but essentially, squat pot, squat short neck, and an arm that points down gives you a heavier whiskey. Long neck, a horizontal arm, or even one that has a little bit of up angle, gives you a lighter whiskey. Because what happens when you distill, I mean, we know that when you distill, you're essentially like you're working with the two different boiling points of alcohol and water. Mm-hmm. Alcohol boils at a lower temperature, water at a higher. So as you turn the heat up, the alcohol comes off first. It's really a simplification because a lot of the water comes with it. A lot of other things comes with it. And it's the other things that come with it, other alcohols, I mean, what are generally referred to as congeners and fusel oils. Okay. There's a whole load of those.
Yes.
Exactly. So what happens is it's all that stuff is starting to rise off the heated liquid. And as it goes up the stack, or as it gets in the ball, or as it gets in the arm, the longer that path is, the harder it is for the vapor to get out, the more of it will condense and fall back in.
Okay.
So if you have a short neck, a downward pointing arm, it's easy for everything to get out. So you get a heavier whiskey. Whereas with a long neck, really all that's getting out is the lightest stuff, the alcohol and some of those things.
What do you mean by heavy versus light? Is it how it looks? Is it alcohol? Is it
flavor? It's flavors and texture as well. It actually does feel heavier in your mouth. I mean, the classic comparison in Scotch is Glenfarclas, which is just very squat, very short neck, sharply down pointed. It's called a line arm. And then Glenmorangie, and they have the tallest stills in the business. They have like a 16-foot stack on them. They're actually old gin stills. And they and it gives you a much lighter, more elegant spirit. You don't get like one of these, like the squat still whiskeys will actually have like a hint of sulfur to it, maybe even a kind of a meaty taste to it, and that sounds good, but you got to remember that the barrels they're putting it in have charcoal on the inside and it's a filter. So I know talking to some distillers here, Dad's Hat, Herman over at Dad's Hat in Bristol, Pennsylvania. Yeah. People still buy the unaged whiskey, the clear stuff. He makes it differently. He'll strip more of that stuff out, because when he puts it in the barrel, then all that stuff, the congeners, the extra chemicals besides the water and the alcohol, react with what's in the wood to create other flavors. But if they don't have that wood to react with, they're just kind of nasty.
Right.
Okay.
He strips more of that out. But yeah, I mean, aging is, it's a whole mess of stuff going on. It's not, I mean, there's interaction with the wood. It's stripping flavor out of the wood. It's also oxidizing with the oxygen transfer through the semi-porous wood. There's an odd maturation process where the alcohol and water molecules are physically combining. Yeah, that's a weird one. I'm still trying to understand that.
Did I hear you say that there was charcoal in the barrels?
The barrels are charred on the inside.
Oh, they're charred. Okay.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it's essentially a thin layer of charcoal. And that was one of the things I learned doing the book. It's amazing how effective charcoal is as a filter. It's just insane the amount of surface area in a cubic centimeter of charcoal is crazy. It's something like 300 meters of surface area. I don't know how you.
Oh wow. Huh.
Yeah, it's nuts.
And it's like a sponge, is it? It just.
Yeah, and it just pulls stuff out. And yet, other stuff is getting into the wood and combining with various compounds in the lignin, for instance. Lignin, and when alcohol gets to the lignin in the wood, it breaks down into, things that taste like fig, things that taste like tobacco, things that taste, and then there's a whole bunch of vanilla in the wood that's being pulled out. It's an amazing thing that goes on in there. And of course, that's where all the color comes from.
Right.
When it comes off the still, it looks like water. I hate saying that because the refractive index is a little different.
Okay.
In the light, you can actually tell the difference between alcohol and water because it looks different. It shines differently.
Okay. Presumably, you can smell it, certainly.
Oh, you can definitely smell it. Yeah. And those fumes. Actually, if you put it on your fingers, you can feel it too.
Yeah.
The viscosity is slightly.
It is different, and it also evaporates pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Right.
So to get back to the last thing on your label, the sherry influence.
Yeah, high sherry aging percentage.
Yeah, so pretty much anymore, I think like 90% of Irish and Scotch whiskey is aged in bourbon barrels, used bourbon barrels, because there's just so many of them. They're cheap. I mean, you can only use a bourbon barrel. To make bourbon, you can only use it once. It has to be a new barrel. So they use it once and they're like, what do I do with this? I'll sell it to a distillery. And they ship them across the Atlantic in box. I mean, they break them down and essentially just throw the staves in.
So it's like IKEA for barrels.
Right.
Yeah, flat pack them all. And
Yeah. And then they just, I mean, they go to a cooperage, like a Speyside cooperage in Scotland, and they just reassemble. And the thing is, they don't bundle them because they're actually making them larger, because the standard size in the Scotch and Irish whiskey industries, I want to say it's like 225 liters instead of 200. It's not a lot, but it's more. So they just put everything back together and it fits. I mean, it's amazing. If you've never been to a cooperage, they do all this stuff by eye.
Oh, gosh.
It's not a machine. It's incredible because all the staves are just slightly different. It's amazing to watch. They do one in under a minute.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, Christina, you look like you've heard a lot of science and you're like, I'm thinking now. There's a lot happening.
Well, yeah. So I've done some thinking about why I don't like whiskey. And I do like smoked whiskey. So I'm the weird one that likes smoked whiskey. And I've realized this, and I don't know how this translates. So Lou, you probably can explain this back to me, because I've figured out, so I don't like oaked wines. And I've realized that's what I don't like in the whiskey, the strong oaked flavor. But when it's smoked, that kind of takes over that. So then that's fine for me. So are there other whiskeys besides smoked whiskeys that wouldn't have that strong oaked flavor? Or am I just amateur houring this and that's just not a thing?
No, everyone likes what they like. That's okay. Yeah.
That's absolutely true. I think what you might want to try is the ones with the heavier sherry influence.
Okay.
Because it sounds to me like, and I'm not in your mouth. what you're objecting to is, sorry. What you're objecting to is the bourbon oak more than anything else. I mean, and bourbon just flat out has it. It's unavoidable. It's the biggest influence in bourbon. There's a rule of thumb in the Scotch business: 50% of the flavor comes from the barrel. With bourbon, it's more like 80. Because they're new barrels. They haven't been used before, whereas Scotch and Irish are over 99% are used barrels. Middleton and now some other distilleries have been experimenting with first use barrels. But I mean, for centuries, it's been used barrels. First, largely sherry. And then as people stopped drinking sherry so much, they've been using a lot of bourbon. It's gotten to the point where distilleries are literally buying sherry, new pressed sherry. They buy the barrels, they pay the sherry bodegas to put the sherry in the barrels and store it for them. And then when it's done, they essentially dump it into a vat, say, it's yours, thank you, bye. Gosh. And they run off with the barrel. It's amazing. And then most of it gets turned into vinegar. Because they just, nobody's drinking sherry.
Yeah.
I've made a note here now to try sherry barreled aged whiskey. So I will look for that.
Yeah. And I feel like they're really well labeled. And maybe this is a question too, because you'll see a lot that's, you know, sort of port finish or sherry finish, or, and I guess, is that more kind of down to the, I guess, sort of the preference of the distiller, or is it to do with, like, you know, kind of their blending program, and how does that kind of figure in, kind of what's aging versus kind of what's blending? Because I know these are different skill sets that
there's aging and there's finishing too.
Okay, right.
So finishing is essentially a way to get sherry flavor into a bourbon aged.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what you do is you age it for what, 10 to 12 years, maybe, in a bourbon barrel. And then you put it in a sherry barrel for anywhere from, I mean, usually it's at least 6 months, usually more like a year. And sometimes even more. I mean, I've had some that were, they were finished in a cognac cask for 8 years.
Oh, wow. Like,
that's more than a finish. Like, come on. Which is actually a relatively new thing, the cognac finishing. I've only been seeing that in maybe the past 5-6 years.
Okay.
does wondrous things for Irish whiskey in particular. I've had a couple of cognac finished Irish that are just phenomenal.
Wow. Okay.
So, but what it's aging. Aging takes a little, you see that Irish whiskeys and Scotch whiskeys usually have longer age statements than Americans. It's not because they're better, it's because they're using a used barrel. It takes longer to get some kind of flavor. It's also a lot cooler than it is in Kentucky.
Sure.
Yeah. Whereas, I mean, you got to think about places like Cavalan whiskey is made in Taiwan. I think the oldest they've ever made is a 5-year-old, because otherwise it's just gone. It evaporates.
Oh,
literally evaporates.
It's gone.
The angel's share. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. 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 It's real.
Yeah. No, and that's ringing a bell, because I did a whiskey tasting, an online whiskey tasting from the L. Mulligan folks here. And one of them was a distillery in India. And that was, they were saying, because it is so hot, they really have to kind of work fast. If you gotta watch it. Very different from anything. And again, obviously I'm no expert, but very different in kind of character, you know, sort of mouthfeel, all of those things from anything else I had tried. And presumably again, the temperature is such a huge factor there.
Yeah, so. I know they've gone to India and Taiwan. They've gone to great lengths to kind of harness that that temperature, that humidity, to produce something fairly close to, but you're absolutely right. It's still different, which I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Work with what you got. So, although that's an interesting question too. And again, guys, feel free to jump in with other questions, Christina.
Katie, I know we're kind of wandering here. Which is fine. That's what always happens.
It's what we do. It's what we do. We get very tangential, but I think it's one of those things that it struck me, realizing it initially, but I guess it just is like there is no kind of equivalent of like bean to bar like you would have in chocolate for whiskey. Like things are, you know, kind of it's almost never going to be kind of made on the farm where the barley was raised. Like there are some exceptions, but I feel like it's gone somewhere at some point, either to sit in a barrel or to be malted, or it would be hard to do the whole process end to end with how things are currently set up in most places.
There are a few exceptions to that, but very few. One of the interesting ones is actually in Ireland, Waterford. And they keep track of literally what field the barley comes from, and then they keep it discreet in this facility they call the Cathedral. I think it has 36 different bins for the different farms coming in, all the same strain of barley.
Okay.
The only difference is the farm that it's grown on. And I set up a blind tasting for a friend of mine. He hadn't heard of Waterford, didn't know what was going on. I gave him three, and they're all the same barley, all the same yeast, all the same distillation. Only difference was the farms. And they're all Irish farms.
Yeah. Even.
Yeah. And he's like, well, I think this one is probably Irish. I think this one's an American single malt. And I'm like, you know, you pull it off at the end of it, it's like, and I have to admit, well, I knew what was going on, and I couldn't figure it out. It's just amazing.
Oh, and we're always such big advocates of saying, you know, the barley is so important for beer, and you know, that we don't give enough credit to where it's being grown, how it's being malted, all of those things. But that's a great example of how really, you know, how much of a variation.
Yeah, I mean, they bent over backwards to make sure that the only difference was where the barley was grown. And it comes singing through.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Again, not knowing very much about this, but like when we drink beer and we judge it, or we're like tasting it, we look for certain characteristics. So when you're drinking whiskey, what makes a good whiskey to you? Like, what do you look for? And if I was, you know, me, well, I am me, who doesn't know very much, and I was trying, you know, whiskey, what would I be looking for in a good Irish whiskey? What sort of characteristics would I really want to see?
Okay. When I'm drinking Irish whiskeys, let's start with that specifically. The first thing I'm looking for is a certain amount of softness, because I have yet to have had a good Irish whiskey that was as aggressive as a bourbon. It just doesn't fit. It's not the right profile.
What is softness?
Softness, No, that's what I mean. A completely fair question. Let's turn it around and say what's aggressive, what's assertive. Hot flavors.
Okay.
More of that mule kicking, but not alcohol. No, I'm trying to put together a story why some whiskeys are hot at 86 proof and others at 110. You just go, oh my, oh, that's very nice. And they tell you the proof, you're like, yeah.
Right.
It's sometimes it is alcohol, obviously, but not always. And there are other factors involved. We used to have this thing where we would ask the distillers, and it was much easier in those days because when I first started writing about whiskey, there were three distilleries in Ireland. You'd ask them, so what makes an Irish whiskey? And they'd say, well, it's triple distilled. I'm like, well, no, Cooley isn't. Oh, well, it's pot still. No, Bushmills isn't. And we'd go all through. And finally, at the end, they said, well, it's made in Ireland. Okay. And one guy went further than that and said, you know, and that's a lot of because that's where it's aged. And the temperature and the climate and the weather and the humidity have a lot to do with it. And I do think that has a lot to do with the character of typical Irish whiskey. They don't have that aggressive hot flavor to them. I can think of maybe two Irish whiskeys I've had that were hot. And both of them were over 100 proof, so some of that might have been the alcohol. So that would be something I'm looking for in a single pot still, like Redbreast. I'm looking for a particular intense fruitiness, and that's coming from the fermentation and from that raw barley. Another thing about Irish whiskey, it's not a rule or a regulation. It's just how it's made, because that's, I always come back to, I don't always, anyway, I sometimes think of what the French winemakers mean when they talk about terroir, because they're not just talking about the ground that the grapes are grown in. They're talking about the whole thing. Someone who's been making wine in that same place for five generations. And that's what I think is a lot of the effect on Irish whiskey. Irish distillers tend not to drive their stills as hard. They don't push the stills with a lot of heat. So the result of that is you get a lot more of the fermentation character carrying over rather than being driven off. And you do pick up those. It's like beer. You're picking up esters. You're picking up floral notes, fruit notes, and it's all coming from the fermentation. So that's what I'm looking for in an Irish whiskey. Obviously, that would be different. I mean, in a Canadian whiskey, for instance, I'd be looking. I was going to say I'd be looking for caramel, but what I'm looking for is one that keeps the caramel a little under control.
it can be a little much.
A little much sometimes, yeah. But that's what I mean. In all of them, at any time, I'm usually looking for balance. I mean, just like a beer. And yet also just like a beer, sometimes I want to get smacked in the face.
Right.
So sometimes I'll get a 5 or 6 year old 100 proof bourbon, because that's what I want that day. I feel like waking up, and that'll do it. That'll do
it. Oh God. I think that would put me to sleep. Yeah.
Yeah. The first one or two wake you up, but then it's over the definitely peak and down the other side.
Yeah. And I'm just like, oh, go ahead, Katie. Yeah.
No. We want to talk through what this.
I think like. So. Yeah. I was going to say exactly that. So you read my mind. Yeah. Mm.
And I'll hold my question then for after.
So, first of all, and yours is, you've got a wider mouth glass there.
Right.
Lisa, you've got a, is that one of the,
got a funny
one of the Irish ones with the,
it,
with
it
the,
is, this is a Tua. So
yes, it is, I have yes. one of those. It's in the back of the closet. Lovely. I should have gotten yeah. it out. So on, I have a just the classic Glencairn. On either one of those, and this is something I just learned 2 years ago, 3 years ago. If you tilt it up like so, uh-huh. and start smelling here, and then move the glass down or your nose up, whichever comes more naturally, you'll actually notice a difference. The heavier aromas are coming out at the bottom and you're getting the lighter, more floral aromas up at the top, especially if you've got your thumb under there heating it.
Okay, yeah.
There's more stuff coming off.
That's interesting.
But so at the bottom, I'm getting more grain and honey. Almost like a wildflower honey. And then as I move, oh yeah.
I Sorry. Do get honey.
Yeah.
As I move up, I'm getting more almost like a citrus candy.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely get a little bit of that vanilla as well.
Right. And you get the vanilla in the metal. Because really what I'm thinking of,
yeah.
Do you remember circus peanuts? Those kind of orange spongy things.
Oh my
That's
gosh.
What I mean. When I talk about citrus candy, it's right there. It's so strange. There are some whiskeys, like Irish, I'll almost always pick up some of that honey and the circus peanuts. Canadian whiskeys, it's roasted nuts and pencil shavings. I don't know where it's coming from. It makes me crazy. But, you know, and the worst thing is, you know, you'll get one of those and somebody will mention to us that, you know, I always get this. And then for the rest of your life, you're like, oh my God, it's there. Where am I? How did I not notice that before?
So, and smell is very evocative. So if you
really is,
you know, it's something that you smelled in your youth and you associate it with something else. It's like, oh, that's what it means to me, you know? And
this is what I keep telling people. Definitely. You know how to smell this stuff. You already know, you just haven't made the connection yet. In tasting whiskey, I talk about it as the Karate Kid method. You know, you've been doing that wax on, wax off thing. Yeah. You just didn't know why.
No, absolutely. And I think that's a great point that, you know, people who are beer nerds who are very used to saying, well, I get this, I get that, and are quite confident about it. But then when they try something new, they kind of are like, well, what are other people saying? What should I be getting? And like you were saying before, you don't want to be prescriptive. You want to say, well, what are you?
Because you ruin it then. You short circuit the whole thing. I remember I used to do, I used to be on the tasting panel at the New York Times. They'd invite me up and I'd come in and it was me and Eric Asimov, the wine writer, and usually another guest, sometimes from a brewery, sometimes from a liquor store, and Florence Fabricant, the food writer. Mm. And I loved that because Florence would always come up with this shit from way out in left field.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Completely culinary. I'm like, oh my God, she's right.
Yeah.
Which is great. I love having someone in like, well, and Eric with the wine references as well. You know, people just, it's not what you're used to thinking of. They're there. You just haven't made that connection.
No, absolutely. And the pencil shavings is, yeah, absolutely. It's one of those where like, I only think about it in kind of whiskey terms. I don't think about it mostly for beer, but now that you've said it, now I'm like, you know, there are some black IPAs when they've gone wrong that get the pencil shaving character.
I got it directly over the weekend. I was at Shy Bear in Lewistown. They had a beer that was aged on cedar.
Oh.
I've only ever had two of them in my life. It was it was more than that. It was a whole grab bag. It was a wet hop pale ale fermented with Kvike yeast aged on cedar.
Oh, so. Wow.
There's a lot going on there.
I gotta have that.
Yeah.
We threw all the adjectives together and saw what we came up with.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny. Mm. Wow. Yeah, but no, because I definitely get like, I feel like with this one, it is one is it's a good, I think just a good one to start with because it's not, I don't want to say basic because that has a whole bad like negative connotation now. And that's not what it is, but it's soothing and just has a nice, I don't know, comforting honestly, flavor.
This one, and one of the reasons I suggested it, people always say, you know, what's your favorite whiskey? Of course they do, right? Of course they ask. And I always give them the standard, well, you know, it depends on where you are and what you've had and what you're doing that day. And then I, you know, every time I can't help myself from thinking, but if you actually put a gun to my head, that's one of the ones I might blurt out. I really, really like this whiskey.
Yeah.
It's got a little bit of everything for me. Everything but the smoke. It doesn't have the smoke.
Yeah, but it's got that, I like the leathery kind of thing too, without it being too much. I've had some where it's too much of that, at least for me. For other people, it might be perfect, but I think it's got the nice, really nice little touch of it. So yeah, because I can recall like going to the whiskey library in Manhattan years ago with a friend, and we were just going to be like, we're going to be very sophisticated and get the most leathery whiskey we can find and just sit in those big chairs and that was our only, you know, suggestion when they came to take order. We're like, we want something very leathery. And they're like, are you sure? And we're like, yes.
Oh, yes.
And they were lovely about it. So we ended up with something that was good, but probably maybe not what we were really looking for. But they gave us what we asked for. And that's, you know.
There you go.
So, yeah. No, absolutely. And then like to get nerdy again. So, you know, in Ireland, and actually maybe this is a question, is it just Ireland or is it elsewhere? We have the technical file for how whiskey
is.
And I know that some people are happy with it. Others want to change bits of it. Maybe you could just sort of talk a little bit about what it is and how it works.
I have to say one of the most interesting, and I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit here. One of the most interesting thing for me about the technical file is that it's already been changed, which I thought, you know, they're going to write this thing and then we're stuck with it. And they're like, no, okay, that sounds good. Wow, okay. Every major whiskey making country has its version of the technical file, except Japan. They were actually just working on theirs.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of cool. For America, it's the standards of identification. For Scotland, it's the Scotch Whiskey Act. I can't remember the name of it in Canada. It's some kind of tax thing, which essentially is what ours is.
Yeah.
And it lays down the rules for what is and what isn't whiskey, and what you can, if you call it a certain thing, then you must comply with these parameters. The technical file talks about age. It talks about distillation protocols. It talks about the mash, and that's where people, I think, mostly got ruffled because the single pot still thing. Kilbeggan actually made a whiskey and put it in barrels as a single pot still whiskey. And by the time it was ready to drink, it was no longer a single pot still whiskey because the technical file came out and changed the definition.
Oh.
So I think they had to call it a special. I can't remember what the hell they did wind up putting on the label, but they were like, really? Because they put, I think it was like 30% rye in it.
Oh, okay.
Which, you know, I mean, that was a fairly common addition to mash bills in the 1800s in Ireland.
Right.
But because certain distilleries had a lot of influence on the writing of the technical file and didn't do that, I think the original technical file, it was 5% on any other grain other than any malt or raw barley. And then any other grain was limited to 5% of the total. But I don't know if that has actually changed yet or if it's headed to change. I can't remember the dates. But that is changing. So, and that was the thing that amazed me. I didn't think that would, but, and some of that is, I have a friend in the industry, Peter Mulryan down at Blackwater, and Peter's a friggin' bomb thrower. He just, you know, like stuff like that drives him crazy. So, you know, he writes a blog, he gets people talking about it and things happen. I don't mean to make it mean that it's solely him, but Peter definitely stirs the pot. So,
well, and, you know, with that kind of thing, someone has to, right? Otherwise it kind of stagnates and
exactly. You know, things. And I mean, that's what we've got an American single malt definition finally coming into the regulations. And that was because a bunch of the distillers got together and said, look, what you're telling us this is, isn't what it is. Could we change the definition? Because we were working with a, you know, I don't know, 70-year-old definition. And nobody in America was making that kind of whiskey then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I guess it's all weird in America anyway, where so much of it's made in dry counties, but you're still making this. Anyway, it's a whole, it's a weird thing. It's a weird thing.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, I mean, the problem with American whiskey definitions is almost everything is either bourbon or make it just like bourbon, except with rye or wheat or corn. And then, but otherwise, just like bourbon. And then everybody's like, I don't know, that tastes a lot like bourbon to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Christina, you look like you have a, you might have a question.
No, I'm just absorbing all of that.
So if I could, the one thing I wanted to, and I've got it in both books, the drink it every day technique. So I came to drinking whiskey because I was writing for, I was the managing editor at what was then Malt Advocate and is now Whiskey Advocate for 20 years. When we first started, we were a beer magazine. And then in the mid 90s, things didn't go so well for American craft brewing. And the owner decided we were going to become a whiskey magazine, which, you know, way out there, first whiskey magazine in the world. But we did that. And he's like, so if you want to keep doing what you're doing, you'll have to learn to drink whiskey.
Right.
And I was like, I know how to drink whiskey. You like screw up your face and knock it back and wince. Yeah. And
in my case, like,
oh,
I don't know if you know what this is. Red lemonade.
Yes.
Yes. It's an Irish oddity, I think.
Yeah.
Red lemonade. It's not actually lemony at all. But a lot of people would have, you know, a whiskey and a red lemonade, or mix it up.
Yeah.
When you're not really appreciating it, I suppose.
Well, no, I mean, you're not getting everything. You're probably not getting that orange citrus thing. So what he told me was, you have to drink some every day. And he meant it literally. So I started doing an ounce of whiskey every day. And honest to God, it was like backing up to a mule. And I just, here we go again, boom, and it just felt like fire. It was just hot. About halfway through the third week, I think it was like day 24 or something, I'm like, okay, all right, ding ding. I just suddenly tasted fudge. I'm like, what's that? And I take another sip and I'm getting orange notes, and I mean, it's still hot, but it's not, all of a sudden other stuff is coming through. So I looked into this. I wanted to find out more about it. And some of it actually came from, my wife's a biologist. She did, she was in the pharmaceutical industry for years. Essentially, the same receptors on your tongue that register heat, capsaicin, hot peppers, also register alcohol. So if you hit your tongue with alcohol at a high enough level, which spirits are,
sure,
it just, it feels like hot. It feels like hot peppers, and they just start screaming. And the thing is, apparently I was always tasting the fudge and the orange, but the pain receptors were screaming so loud, it wasn't coming through. It was just overwhelming that. And as they became, as my wife put it, upregulated, and I could pour that alcohol in there and not go anymore. Because essentially these nerve cells were like, all right, you're going to keep doing that. Fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Reset, new normal. And that dialed down. And then the flavors started coming through. I mean, it's gotten to the point where I don't even have to ease into it anymore. I can just go from 0 to 110 proof and like, oh, okay. Some nice peach notes, blackberry, a little bit of heat. And most people are like, so you have scar tissue on your tongue. Is on your tongue. Quite. I did. I do spirits judging like anybody else who writes about it. I did a round of all barrel proof whiskeys a few years ago. Everything was 120 proof and up.
Ooh.
And I got to tell you, at the end of it, I was just, my tongue felt like a slab of rubber. It was like, everything had been cleaned off my teeth. It was squeaking. It was just, we were done at the end of that.
There's no palate cleanser there that's going to,
nothing. No, water doesn't help. All it does is take away a little of the pain, but you still can't taste anything.
And I guess that is one of the differences from like judging a, you know, a beer competition, where you might have some of those very high ABV things, but very high ABV is like maybe 10-11%. It's not going to be, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the other thing, I mean, and you know, you do spit.
Yeah.
You have to go on one of those. But if you're doing like 20, spitting's only so effective because there's so much fume.
Yeah.
You're still breathing it. Yeah. Yeah, because one of those taste tests at the Times we did rye whiskeys. And I think, I want to say we had 21. And, you know, Florence and Eric were wine pros. They were just sitting, spitting. And said, by the end of the tasting, we were all just giggling. We were all giddy. It was like, that was really good.
Yeah, I mean, 21 of anything.
Yeah. It got to be a bit much. I was glad I was taking the train home.
Yeah, so. I reckon though you'd have to, after having the 21, you'd have to try number one again to see if you did it justice on a bare tongue. You know what I mean?
That's a good point. Maybe.
I wasn't any mood for it. No, usually, what I mean, when I'm doing my own tastings for an article or for a book or for whatever, I usually don't do more than 6, maybe 8 in a day, because I don't want to get burned out.
Yeah, you want to prepare all of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So my question is about blends.
Ooh.
So I have this notion, or I used to have a notion, that you distill it, you gather it all together, put it in a barrel, put it in a bottle. Is that what happens?
Okay, so in a very small number of cases, yeah. I mean, single barrel whiskey, single cask whiskey, that's exactly how it is. You go through the warehouse, you sample cat. Well, you don't go through the warehouse. Oh, I'll try that one. They know where every barrel is. They tell you these stories about, oh, these barrels were lost and forgot. Bullshit. they know where every single one of them is. But they, you know, they will, take samples from a group of barrels that are all the same age, and bring these little samples back. And these days, I mean, it used to be you had to roll the barrel out and you'd dip the thing in, the thief, and you'd pull some out and you'd pour it and put it in a bottle. Now they just have sparkless battery powered drills and just in the end of it, catch the stream and then stick a little oak plug in and off you go. So it's a lot easier now. But you bring them all back, and if you're doing a single cask, I mean, they may be going through 100, 150 different barrels to find the one that they want. And then you pour that. It may be barrel proof, it may not. Proofing is a whole other thing that I just learned an incredible amount about. It's amazing how adding a completely flavorless liquid to whiskey will change the flavor, and not just diluting it. It's because at different levels of proof, different flavors will come forward. Other flavors will go to the back, and it was stunning. It was a whole new thing for me. Anyway, so if you do that, you've still got to. Oddly, you have to let the whiskey sit for a while. After it comes out of the barrel, you can't put it right into the bottle. You got to let it sit. You have to filter out the bits of charcoal. So a rough filtering there. If it's under 92 proof, 46%, you probably want to chill filter it, which is essentially you get it cold, and then these proteins precipitate out, and you filter them through a cloth filter pad. It's just that if the whiskey gets cold, like when it's being shipped, especially this time of year, obviously, if the whiskey gets cold, it'll get cloudy, and nobody wants cloudy whiskey.
Oh, okay. There's no haze boys in whiskey. No one wants that.
No, we don't like that shit. No.
Thank God. I'm so done with hazy things.
But for some reason, I guess it's, well, I mean, there's some reason. It's a chemical reason that I don't understand.
Right.
There. at 46% and above, doesn't happen.
Right.
So. Okay. This is, I mean, that's one of the reasons you see a fair number of scotches at 92 proof, because they don't want to filter it. Yeah. I mean, there are people out there who claim they can taste if a whiskey's been chill filtered. They can taste if it has a little bit of caramel color in it, which Scotch is allowed to do. Mm-hmm. It's called spirit caramel. It's essentially the wort that is then boiled down to a syrup. So it's all malt. It's still 100% malt, but it adds a little bit of color. And they do it just to get a consistent color from batch to batch. Or at least that's the theory. Because the thing is, if it looks darker, it looks older. I mean, I've had 20-year-old scotches that were like pale, pale straw. I've had 20-year-old scotches that were not quite that, but pretty damn garnet. And some of it is because it's like a first fill sherry barrel and you are getting that much color, and some of it's caramel. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. So those are some of the, so you just have to be aware of that when you're buying. How did we get into this? Oh, blending. I'm sorry. Right. So after spending all that time on the exception, let's get to the rule. So what you're doing there, the blender is actually the most important person, not the distiller, because the blender is taking all those different, I mean, you've got, so you've got sherry casks and, well, okay, you have European oak sherry casks and American oak sherry casks, and then you have the bourbon casks. So you really have three different types of wood that you're dealing with. And then add into that any of the finishes on the end, port, wine, red wine, white wine, Madeira, cognac, even just fresh bourbon. But basically you're working with those three types. So the blender has to decide, if it's a new whiskey, what they're going for, what kind of flavor profile, and how to get to that with what stock they have in the warehouses. If it's an already established whiskey, some of your distilling and aging program is obviously going to be aimed at providing you with a steady source of the components of the blend. Right. Scotch also has a it's not a secret, but it's something they just don't talk about. Almost all the blended scotches have whiskeys in them that the company doesn't own. So they're trading.
Oh.
Yeah, right? Now that, I mean, that, you know, I was making fun of people like, oh my God, it's not all this, they're all the same whiskey. They're all the, that's the, but that was a, really? But they do.
No. Yeah.
And the funny thing is, you know, God, when I first started writing about whiskey, it was 95, 96. I swear to God, half the Scotch distilleries are owned by different companies now. There was like this mad merry-go-round in the last 20 years. And so, you know, you have these established blends and all of a sudden you have to deal with somebody else to get the whiskey you need for them. And it's...
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. And then you look at... because blended Scotch and most blended Irish, no, I'll just say blended Irish. One of the major components is what they call grain whiskey, which is a whole other thing. That's more, they run it through a column still rather than a pot still.
Okay.
It might be any grain. It's often wheat. Sometimes it's malt. It all depends on the price of the market. But they'll run that off at like 180, 190 proof. Very high proof, and then age it. And, you know, the whiskey nerds are like, oh, well, that's not even whiskey. You're not getting any flavor. That's just brown vodka. What you're really getting out of it, and they will bottle some of those as single grain whiskeys. And yeah, when they're young, they don't have a whole lot of thing. They're mostly just sweet. But like a 30-year-old grain is a fantastic whiskey. It's a really cool thing. And it is sweet, but so is all Canadian. And I love drinking Canadian.
So when you see single pot still or single grain, we're talking very different things in terms of what you're getting. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And single malt as well, which is why the whole single thing is kind of confusing. But blended Scotch will be both of those. Sorry, just it'll be single malt and single grain. And the thing to know about single grain is I think there's only 5 grain distilleries in all of Scotland.
Oh,
so okay. Every blended Scotch has it's whiskey all... coming from one of those five distilleries.
Right. Yeah. So it's all about the aging and the blending. And
it's all about the aging and the blending. Yeah. Sorry. I cut you off.
You were all talking about single stuff. So I said single pot still. Does that mean, what does that mean? Everything came from the same pot still? Or is it just a marketing lingo?
Yeah. I mean, so here's what, mostly it is, but that's mainly because there are so few distilleries in Ireland still.
Okay.
I think we're going to come to a point where we're going to do a whiskey of this type, we'll call it, that comes from more than one distillery. And then they're going to have to come up with a new name for that. I don't know what they're going to call it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I guess related to that, we've been seeing, I don't want to say a lot of, because I feel like I see this when I'm at the airport, and maybe so there's a bit of a sort of location bias for this, but
yes,
you know, we'll see the, you know, the whiskey that's been aged in a Guinness barrel or some IPA barrels. And I've tried them. Again, I'm going to say, you know, disclaimer, I've been at the airport. It's been, you know, like 9 a.m. Maybe I'm not at my best, you know, tasting, but.
Oh, and they're sampling them.
Oh yeah. And they're sampling them. Yeah. Okay. So I'm like,
okay,
I don't taste anything beery, or, and I'm like, should I be, am I just missing it? Or is this just purely a marketing thing at this point where they're like, well, these are the barrels we had, and now it's cool to say IPA or whatever it was.
It's definitely cool to say IPA now. the one that, when I go to Ireland, the one that friends want me to bring back, cause we don't have it here, is the cider finish.
Oh, I don't think I've even come across that one. Okay, yeah. So I'll have to keep an eye out.
It may well only be at travel retail. But
okay.
That's the one people want. People who've had it. Well, I mean, and what? 15 years ago, it would have been Green Spot.
So, right, okay, yeah.
Yeah, because we didn't have Green Spot. Yeah. But now it's, everybody wants the Casamay Cider. I want that.
That's fascinating. I did bring back some Red Spot and Green Spot for friends when we visited over the holidays. So at least I'll be patting myself on the back and yay for me.
But
I'm fascinated now that, like, beer barrels, where I'm first of all like, what's a beer barrel in this context?
They're only,
like,
putting it in there so they can age the whiskey in it.
Right. And I'm like, do you get anything from that? I don't know if you do.
Glenfiddich started it. They started with the Innocent Gun. Beers.
Oh yes.
So apparently at that point they wanted to do a beer barrel finish, and they were just dumping the beer. Now again, this is the story I've been told.
Right.
And they were dumping the beer, and some guy's like, wait, we should at least try this.
Yeah.
Okay. First off, somebody would have tried it the very first time you did.
Yeah.
I would have been there.
Yeah.
And they're
me
this
too.
Is really good. Yeah. We should both, right?
Yeah.
So they they made a whole brand out of it, and they've got, God, I don't know how many different flavors they have, a bunch. They have it aged in Scotch casks and Irish casks and rum casks, cognac casks. So, but yesterday I was at a local distillery, Big Spring in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. They had, so the distiller is a home brewer, is a mad home brewer, just all the time. And he had done a Baltic Porter, and he took it over to a local brewer. He's like, oh, try this. I'm like, oh, that's great. We should do a Baltic Porter. We've never done one. So he said, well, how about you do a Baltic Porter, and you can age some of it in this corn whiskey barrel that I did. I did a corn whiskey, and I dumped that, and it was like a four-year-old corn whiskey. And so they dumped it. And while it was in the barrel, they're like, hey, wait a minute. After we dump the beer out, how about you put some whiskey in it and finish it and get the beer? So yesterday they had, everything was finally ready. We had the Baltic Porter, the barrel aged, the whiskey barrel aged Baltic Porter, and then some of the corn whiskey that had been 6 months in the barrel that they had used to age the Baltic Porter. It was a neat little, like, triple boilermaker kind of.
Yeah, yeah, it's all just kind of going, circular.
And clearly different, because I also got a little shot of the corn whiskey that hadn't been aged in the beer barrel. Right. I mean, the two beers and the two whiskeys, clearly different.
Oh, which is,
I mean, that's what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, otherwise, absolutely. Why bother?
Oh, 100%. I feel like we get a lot of the beer aged in whiskey barrels where you get, it's very clear that there's a difference. There's a real, you know, you get that whiskey character in it, but I'm still, again, maybe I've just not had the right ones, but I'm not personally 100% convinced I can tell the ones aged, the whiskeys aged in beer barrels that you're getting.
Were they trying you on both?
That's a good question. I don't think, they were definitely different breweries. Like I'm thinking of the, breweries stroke distilleries, because the brewery I'm thinking of is again, Lochgill. They make an amazing series of sort of imperial stouts that they age in different barrels. There's like a whiskey barrel, rum barrel, all kinds of things. And they have very different character, but I'm just thinking of some of them. Again, I've only had them in airports, but whiskeys in a beer barrel where I'm like, do I get anything? I don't know. It wasn't bad. Yeah, I just didn't get
You got to taste the whiskey before to see if there's anything. And again, if there is anything and if it's any good.
Yeah. Clearly.
And of course, is it worth a premium? Because you know there is one.
Yeah, exactly. So we should all be going to Dublin Airport and saying, I need to try the before.
Yes.
Then, and we'll see how we get on, you know. Because sometimes you are there for a while, you know, you may as well.
That's true.
You know what? I think this is just, we should go on a mission. We should get like a $9.99 seat just to go to Dublin Airport for the free samples.
Just think of that. Yeah.
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 Oh my God. And you could totally do it too. Oh my gosh. But I guess, you know, we'll begin to wrap up a little bit, but I feel like if we want to learn more about some of the Irish whiskeys, again, thinking about either tours we could do or places to go, where should we start? Again, apart from your lovely books, which we're going to keep recommending, but what's a good place? I know you mentioned going to Middleton. So
Middleton's good. Tullamore has a great, great tour.
Okay.
They really do. They have a new distillery. They didn't have a distillery for something like 50 or 60 years. They're just buying whiskey and blending it. They kept making whiskey that way. But they built this fantastic distillery outside of Tullamore. I think they originally just had a visitor center in the town in what was one of their old warehouses.
Okay.
But they built this incredible distillery outside of town, and they're doing tours now. The cool thing with that is they've got, I want to see, two different types of pot stills and a column still, so you can see all of it going. And they use single pot still, single malt, and grain whiskey in their whiskey. It's a blend of all three.
Okay.
So they talk about all three. They know about all three. That's a pretty good tour. Teeling's has a very good tour in Dublin. The Celtic Whiskey Shop has every damn thing. Well, actually, that's not fair. There's other shops that do now. It's just that's where I usually go because that's where I used to go. Or just go to one of the whiskey bars and learn there. I mean, that's what worked for me when I learned about port. I went to a place in Lisbon that just had a whole shitload of ports and people knew what they were talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, and you just learn a lot. So, I mean, the very best way to learn about this stuff is to drink it with someone who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And who's like someone like you who's not going to say, you should be getting this, you should be getting this, is going to say, I can help you.
Yeah, I'm not selling it. I'll admit, exactly. I'm selling my books, but I'm not selling whiskey. And that's actually, that was one of the things I do not regret when I did the books, didn't put a bunch of tasting notes in.
Right. Yeah. So, you want people to have their own thoughts, ideas.
Well, actually, I was thinking more about sales because it didn't go out of date that way.
That's a great point. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I don't really like telling people what they ought to be tasting. Anytime I do talk about it, I want to make sure I preface it by saying, this is what I'm getting.
Yeah. And plus, I do feel like you have to account for things like seasonality and just things that there are going to be differences. You know, there was a hot summer or whatever it was, you know.
So. Oh, yeah. I mean, there was a batch of Highland Park came out. The Orkneys are famously windy. It's just blowing all the time. And that was from malt that they kilned on a day when there wasn't a whole lot of wind. It was an odd day.
Yeah.
So the draft on the kiln was not as much. That batch of whiskey didn't get as smoky.
Oh, gosh. It's interesting. Yeah, yeah. Just a particular day is,
yeah,
you know,
it's pretty wild. Yeah, oh, just one thing or another. I mean, I remember we were, they had, I won't go into the details, there's a lot of details, but essentially I was tasting whiskeys at Glenfiddich, 15-year-olds, we were putting together a bottle, and I tasted from two different barrels. They'd been filled within 15 minutes of each other on the same day, sat beside each other in the warehouse, both from the same bourbon distiller, noticeably different. Don't know why.
Be like because one came off the still at a different time?
Different time in the distillation run.
Maybe.
Might have been that much difference in the wood in the barrels.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's crazy.
There was a thing. The distiller at Buffalo Trace, Harlan Wheatley. We were talking about, you know, how do you pick the wood that goes into the barrels? Obviously, the coopers do. The distillers don't. Mm. How do you then pick those barrels, put those in? And he said, well, you know, we can control parts, but when it all comes together, he said, you don't really have a lot of control on that. So I think of it as a controlled chaos. You know, yeah. It's you've always got the same components coming in, at least. Then things get a little weird, but they get weird within a certain area, and that's where you make your whiskey. Yeah,
definitely.
And that's why blenders are so important.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, before we wrap up, Christina, any questions from you? I feel like you look like you've learned many things.
I know. I feel like I'm like.
No, we love this.
I just have one. It's kind of a silly question. So I've watched some documentaries on Netflix about whiskey heists. So like some of this whiskey is like just astronomically expensive. And so probably a controversial question, but like, is this whiskey that much, is it actually that much better that it's worth ridiculous amounts of money? Or is it really like depends on which one, and it kind of, because some of the, I'm just like, how is it?
It's, what are those whiskey auctions? So
it's not so much the quality, it's the rarity.
Okay, yeah.
That's really what it comes to, because it is really rare. Like I said, the whole Angel's Share thing. I mean, you start out with 10,000 barrels of whiskey, and first off, when it gets to be 6 years old, they're going to bottle a bunch of it to make their basic flagship whiskey. So there's, say, half of it gone. In that same 6 years, in Kentucky, probably at least 15% of it has evaporated. Mm. Boom, that's gone. So there's another, 1,500 barrels gone. Then you're going to bottle some of it at 10. You're going to bottle some of it at 12. By the time, and some of the barrels are going to go bad. They're going to leak, or they're going to have just a sap pocket in the wood, something. You're going to lose more barrels there. The evaporation keeps going. Some of the barrels will be used and blended into other whiskeys. By the time you get to 20 years old, there's not much left. You know, they release and I'm probably wrong here, I'm just off the top of my head, they release about 1,500 bottles of all the types of Pappy Van Winkle in a year. So the 23-year-old, a couple hundred, and everyone wants one. So that's why the price is. Is it good? Yeah, I mean, I've got a bottle of 15-year-old, and I love it. It's a really good whiskey. Is it worth? I mean, the bottle I had, if I hadn't opened it today, would be worth $10,000. Would I pay that for it? Never, never. I would never pay that much for a bottle of whiskey. I mean, is it really good? Yeah, but you're not paying for good anymore.
Yeah, and I, having done a couple of the both virtual and now in-person tastings, like with the L. Mulligan folks who just choose amazing things, and it's wonderful. But that's the big thing they're advocating is like, these are meant to be drunk. You're not meant to be buying them and just hoarding them away, you know,
right?
Like a dragon, and just, you know, it. No, you know, it's fine if you enjoy it and you're saving it, but come on, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even these guys, I'll get collectors who tell me, well, I always buy two, one to keep and one to drink. I'm like, well, I buy two and I drink them. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't understand. I remember that was one of the first whiskey festivals I went to. I think it might have actually been the second one. One of the very first people who was a brand ambassador. I mean, now everybody has a brand ambassador, but Anthony Burnett was one of the first, and he worked for Glenmorangie. And I remember him talking, we were getting towards the end of the night, and he said, you know, I just wish these people would always remember, we make it to drink. We don't make it to fuss over. We don't make it to look at. We don't make it to invest. We make it to drink, always.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, here, here. How about you, Katie? Any other final thoughts, questions?
Oh, I think I just realized how little I know about whiskey. You know, there's so much.
I learn stuff all the time. I'm not exaggerating. It never goes away. It never ends.
Yeah.
Yay! Yes. There you go. Yeah, you'll be employed forever. I love it. But no, that's, right. That's right. That is why we're doing this, is like whiskey 101 for beer nerds. Right. There's more to find out. There's always more you can deep dive into. We may well do a follow-up episode in future. Maybe. Just putting this out there in the universe, maybe Katie, Christina, maybe we'll go somewhere and do something on site.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out now, how am I going to sell the sip a day to my husband?
Purely medicinal.
Oh, well, look, I think every household in Ireland has the medicinal whiskey somewhere.
Right.
You know, even my parents, they don't drink, but they have whiskey. You know,
absolutely. I mean, to get over a cold, or you know, if you can mix it with a little lemon, you know, it does
definitely
work. It does work. Well, with that, I will say thank you to Katie and Christina. But Lou, thank you so much. We are so appreciate you coming on, because we have learned a ton. But where can folks find you? You've got a lot going on right now.
I do. I mean, obviously the books, which you so kindly put up behind you, and they're available obviously on Amazon and the usuals, and at your independent bookstore. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. Something I learned from Michael Jackson when he was still alive and writing about whiskey and beer: my name is my brand, so that's my social. LEWBRYSON. Yep. And as you mentioned, I started a podcast. It's about eating and drinking in Central Pennsylvania, you know, I pontificate about other things too. That is Seen Through a Glass, and it's available on all the major sources.
Absolutely. And I think it's Stag Podcast on Instagram as well. You've got some lovely behind the scenes photos.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So don't want people to miss out on those, because they are really nice. And again, recent episodes on, I think you had local distillers, you had the Pennsylvania Farm Show. There's lots of love there. So
we had the whole thing about Trogs for the holidays.
That was fun. Yeah, I'm a big Trogs fan. Yeah, that was wonderful. Folks who have not had Mad Elf, you're missing out. I know.
Honestly, I know. One of the best holiday beers made anywhere.
It really is. And I don't like cherry. I don't like fruit in beer, but that is
they
glorious.
Do a really great job with it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. So with that, I will say again, we are at Beer Ladies Pod in all of the places. You can go to our link tree, just look for Beer Ladies Podcast. You can find us there. You can support us. You can buy merch. You can buy us a pint. You can do all the things, but go buy Lou's book. And, you know, we'll maybe do another episode on whiskey in the future. But for now, we will say thank you very much and see you next time. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Thanks.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.